Barack Obama is at the UN today. Is he speaking among friends or facing an angry mob?
The ugly American, where intrigue is everywhere, where armies spring up overnight, and half a billion sticks of human dynamite wait only for a spark to ignite them.
This is a new day. It is a new era.
Obama's charisma may not be enough to overcome resentment over the U.S. role in global finances and conflicts. Will he be seen as an ugly American?
Now, I don't mind telling you that I was afraid out there this afternoon.
Anti-Americanism, it's ugly on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 23rd. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Coming up this hour, transit plot warnings and empty threats. The latest on the terror probe in New York and Colorado. And college football upsets skew the rankings and making a grilled cheese sandwich by committee. Is that a good idea?
But first, Raihan Salam joins us. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and blogger for the National Review. Raihan, is Obama still in his honeymoon period with his international leaders and colleagues?
I think President Obama is one of the most beloved American leaders we've had in decades, but that is precisely the reason why this might be the start of a real anti-American backlash. When President Obama inevitably disappoints his greatest, most ardent admirers abroad, I think that it's going to get ugly.
Doesn't sound like the guy can win. Raihan Salam, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. First, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, getting ugly is maybe on the mind of President Obama. He's going to be delivering his message in a speech to the full UN General Assembly later this hour. Up first, he meets with Japan's new prime minister, and that's in the next hour. 10 are now dead in the floods covering Georgia and Alabama. Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue has seen the deep waters firsthand.
This was not coming up on the porch. This was just literally submerged houses in many areas.
Damages are estimated now in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Rains in the southeast are expected to ease today. Some good news.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports the White House is looking at alternatives to sending more troops to Afghanistan. The vice president is pushing a plan that would actually reduce American forces there. It would focus on rooting Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan and Pakistan. The Fed wraps up a two-day meeting in Washington today. It isn't expected to move interest rates, but investors will look at the Fed statement for clues on what's ahead.
Today, the Senate Finance Committee gets back to work on its health care bill after working into the night yesterday. Hundreds of amendments to wade through on Senator Max Baucus's bill. Markets edged up yesterday. The Dow opens next hour at 98.30. The S&P starts trading at 10.72. And the NASDAQ begins at 21.46. Investors will be looking at that Federal Reserve meeting, which at about 2.15 this afternoon will conclude whether it will raise or lower interest rates. Investors are betting that nothing will change. The ugly American, Celeste set it up there at the top with the famous movie from 1963. That was Marlon Brando there.
Yeah.
Did you recognize him? Is ugly America just an outmoded concept, an old 60s movie? Does the term have relevance today? Tell us the traits of an ugly American. Can Americans get a makeover? And maybe there are no ugly Americans.
I love you just the way you are.
Mark Meyerowitz. The ugly American is a perception that other countries have had of the United States. I don't think that's a fair term, and anyone that uses it, I think uses it unfairly at this point. America in the age of Obama is the engaging American.
8778-MY-TAKE. Weigh in, won't you?
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. President Obama debuts at the United Nations today. He's going to be speaking before the General Assembly, but is he going to be talking as a beloved American or an ugly one? We're asking you about that. Does the image of the ugly American still exist? Is it still relevant? If so, what is the image of an ugly American? Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, we're talking to Raihan Salam. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and blogger for the National Review. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Raihan said the honeymoon for President Obama with the international community is nearly over. We're also joined by Richard Wolff, journalist and author of the best-selling book Renegade, The Making of a President. So, Richard, do you agree? Is the honeymoon just about over?
Well, I think on international terms, we're reaching this sort of turning point where there's an expectation that Obama can deliver on some of these things that the international community is hoping for. But his popularity, honestly, if you look at the numbers, it's still incredibly high. People have this love affair with him around the world. He's way more popular than he is than their national leaders. So if you look at the numbers, you know, you have to get kind of ahead of the curve to say the honeymoon's over, but they do want him to take steps on things that matter to them, and that includes tough stuff like climate change.
So, Raihan, what do you think, in your mind, is fueling the end of his honeymoon period? Is it the U.S. role in the financial collapse?
I think that there's a structural tension between Obama maintaining his popularity at home and also maintaining his popularity internationally. I think it's absolutely true that he retains this tremendous popularity, in part because internationally, the folks who followed the election very closely started to tune out at a certain point. And now what they're going to find is that in terms of achieving some of his domestic political objectives, he's going to have to take a more populist turn, one that's going to involve taking steps away from, for example, free trade. It's going to involve taking some steps away in terms of sacrificing some of his goals on climate change. And I think that is going to engender an intense backlash, in part because President Obama raised expectations so high internationally, as is still reflected in those high popularity ratings that Richard was describing.
Well, clearly one of the things that Barack Obama said as he was campaigning was that he was open to speaking with any world leader, and he's now probably avoiding Ahmadinejad in the hallways of the United Nations. So there's one issue already where he's had to kind of take a step back. Is that affecting his perception of him abroad?
Well, it's tricky because it's not obvious that refusing to talk to Ahmadinejad directly is something that is actually diminishing his popularity in the Muslim world, insofar as actually Ahmadinejad's popularity within that space has also deteriorated. But it is a clear indication that the game plan is changing, and it's changing very, very fast for the Obama White House. This was going to be their big diplomatic break, and then they saw events overtake them. And even though they started sticking with the script early on, they had to change it midway. And I think you're also seeing that on Afghanistan, where the Obama White House's approach has been, we're the responsible ones. We're going to pursue a counterinsurgency strategy. And already they're saying, wait a second, maybe this is not going to work for us in domestic political terms. And that could create resentment throughout South Asia, for example.
Well, let's keep it outside of the domestic political calculus, because I mean that's really the dynamics of anti-American sentiment internationally. Raihan and Richard, I wonder if you could respond to this. Does a celebrity president or an individual charismatic leader drive this anti-American or pro-American sentiment, or are there deeper dynamics economically and otherwise that really determine America's place in the world that no individual leader can really overcome? Raihan?
I think that having the kind of charisma that President Obama has can make a huge difference. I think it can make him a more credible spokesman with international audiences. The reason why I'm reluctant to separate out the domestic political piece is that the same folks who think that Barack Obama is too cosmopolitan, that he's not sufficiently focused on the interests of the American middle class, are the people that he has to answer to because they're his voters. And so that creates a tension right there.
Richard?
Oh, look, anti-Americanism has a long and storied history. It's to do with America's rise and its power. It's in the eyes of much of the rest of the world, it's lack of accountability. But I actually think having a popular president does make a difference. Look at Obama's speech to the Muslim world in Cairo. It's incredibly rare that you have a president where parts of the world, especially in the Middle East, are tuning in for the first time to hear what he has to say about their issues and their identity. You know, anti-Americanism can be overcome with some respect, some mutual respect, and that's what we're seeing. Whether you can translate that into something else in terms of foreign policy is the test they're facing now. But having people pay attention to an American message from an American president at a time when anti-Americanism has been very, very high, maybe at an all-time high, is something new. It's a departure, and it's an opportunity for a new administration.
So, Richard, let's just follow that up. Can he translate this, I guess, before his honeymoon ends? Can he translate his current popularity into foreign policy? This is what President Obama said yesterday at the beginning of a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
We have to summon the will to break the deadlock that has trapped
generations of Israelis and Palestinians in an endless cycle of conflict and suffering. We cannot continue the same pattern of taking tentative steps forward and then stepping back.
So those are some pretty strong words, but we've heard strong words out of previous administrations in the White House. Is he going to be able to, translate this into some kind of political capital in the Middle East?
Well, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a story of false dawns and dashed hopes, but what we haven't seen in the last two predecessors of President Obama is a personal engagement early on. Early on, this is the first year, this is the first few months. So to have a president doubling down on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, saying, well, we didn't get anywhere with settlements, but we're going to go straight to final status negotiations, that's ambitious. It's also putting a lot of his personal credibility on the line here. And, you know, peace processes can start in the most unlikely circumstances. You look at someone like George Mitchell, who had a key role in the Northern Ireland peace agreement. You know, the leaders then that he was negotiating with were very hard line, and he was negotiating on the back of major terrorist attacks by the IRA. So these things can take different turns, but again, the Middle East has been a sort of wasteland for peace efforts before. You know, it's not clear that personal popularity matters. What does matter is personal commitment from a president.
Well, Raihan, let me get your response to what's going on in the Middle East. I mean, it seems to me if Obama is walking away from the settlement demand that was the original position and going to final status, he's already signaled he's willing to cave on an important issue. Why don't the Israelis just respond the same way on final status, Raihan?
Yeah, I think that is a big issue. I think that when you're looking at the term Nixon going to China, the reason why it's so resonant is that you have to have a lot of credibility before you make this kind of a demand. And so, for example, traditionally American presidents would first try to get concessions from the Palestinian side, then go to the Israelis, and then bring pressure to bear. And I think the reason why Obama's efforts have not resonated in Israel this time around is that there's a sense among the Israeli public, and not just right-of-center Israelis, that the Americans are coming to them and asking for concessions without first getting those concessions on the Palestinian side. And so I think that there's a sense that Obama is not being quite as serious as, for example, Clinton was during his presidency. And I think that that means that when you see Obama shifting from time to time, when you see him make one set of demands and make a different set of demands, when you see him reverse on Ahmadinejad, when you see him possibly reverse on Afghanistan, there's a real question of who are we dealing with here? I mean, he remains kind of an enigma to international leaders who are inclined to like him, but don't know who exactly they're dealing with.
Well, since you mentioned Ahmadinejad, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs had some very tough words yesterday, about the nuclear program there.
They've got some decisions that they're going to have to make that their failure to answer or failure to even talk about, I think, will further galvanize the international community.
Quickly, Richard, what's going to happen when the Ahmadinejad arrives? Are we going to see some tough talk under the nuclear program in Iran?
I'm sure we'll see some histrionics from Ahmadinejad, but listen, although Obama has backed off this idea of face-to-face talks, the negotiations, the sit-down that's going to happen next week, are the highest-level talks with Iran on these kinds of face-to-face, direct security issues we've ever seen since the revolution. So it's a big deal. It's a chance to obviously see whether there is any movement. And if it doesn't work, it's also a chance to rally support internationally for the kinds of sanctions the administration has got against North Korea. So the idea that this is just another routine meeting is missing the point.
Is the ugly American a relevant concept, Richard Wolff, in the 21st century in the few seconds that we have? And Raihan, we'll get a quick response from you.
No, I don't. And actually, Obama's trying to play off it and say, look, I am defying your expectations because I'm a different kind of American.
Look at
and
me
that's
now.
Working so far.
What do you think of me now? Raihan, is ugly American a relevant notion these days?
Yeah, I think it's very relevant because the anxious American middle class is feeling its own kind of pain. But when you're looking at the developing world, they're looking at Americans and thinking, hey, you know, we have way bigger problems.
Raihan Salam is a fellow at the New America Foundation and blogger for the National Review. We were also joined by Richard Wolff, journalist and author of the best-selling book Renegade, The Making of a President.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
And now in this segment, some quick takeouts on some stories that we want to be current on with some correspondents around the country that are following them. Celeste?
Well, there's about 500 or 600 amendments to get through for the Senate on the health care reform bill. Joining us from Washington is Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So, Todd, how many of these amendments are just put in there to kind of are poison pills to kill the bill?
Well, it's hi, Celeste. Good morning. It's unclear exactly how many poison pills there are. You know, on a bill that's this high profile and where the divide between the parties, you know, sort of the liberal Democrats and the Republicans is so very wide, poison pills don't always really work because the other side's not going to fall for it. We're not going to not have health reform because of one nasty little amendment. But you will see some more amendments on hot button issues, things like abortion, you know, amendments making sure that no benefits go to pay for abortion, even though the bill already does that. It was made clear to senators last night the bill does not provide any federal benefits for abortion whatsoever. You will probably still see abortion amendments to make it tough for conservative Democrats like Mary Landrieu down in Louisiana, who is pro-life and has a strong pro-life voting record, make it tough for her to vote against it.
So what about the amendments that may be playing up to special interests? Are we seeing some of those in there as well?
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. I mean, do you have all morning?
No, Todd,
we do not.
Yeah, unfortunately, I wish we did because healthcare, look, part of the reason why healthcare is such a mess is that it is rife with special interests. And there are lots and lots and lots of amendments that protect everything from podiatrists to respiratory therapists. Lots of amendments making sure that medical device manufacturers, insurance companies, drug makers don't have to pay higher fees, which is part of how this bill is financed. But last night was really interesting. I want to get to this really quickly because today will be a vote in the committee that is just right down the alley of special interests. Poor seniors are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid because they're poor. And they used to get their drugs through Medicaid at a very low rate. And after they passed the prescription drug benefit a few years ago, part of the sweetening deal for pharma was that instead of the low Medicaid rate, the government would pay a higher Medicare rate, higher to the tune of almost $90 billion over 10 years. There's an amendment hanging out there right now saying, why are we just paying this higher Medicare rate? Why don't we pay the lower Medicaid rate just like we used to and save $90 billion. We'll see how they vote.
Well, they're hoping to get it done by Friday. We'll see if that actually happens. Thanks, Todd Zwillick. He's our Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Our next takeout now from Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, who's reporting on the very important mission down in Washington to develop new regulations for the financial sector. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is going to testify before Barney Frank's committee in the House of Representatives. Louise, legislators have been pretty tough on Geithner before the cameras. What of substance is likely to come out of this committee meeting?
Well, this is the start of 11 hearings in the House about regulatory reform, and a lot of the members have additional questions because it's this week and the next few weeks that they're marking up the bill. And, you know, the bill started coming right out of the Obama administration's proposals, but now members of the House are, you know, tweaking it in the ways that they see fit. And so these hearings, the one with Geithner this morning, and there's another one with the heads of different banking regulators this afternoon, should serve the purpose of letting them ask kind of more in the weeds questions that will help them in the wording of the bills. And, you know, details are everything in these kind of reforms.
Well, a big weed that you reported on earlier this week is Chris Dodd over in the Senate's idea of an Uber regulator to put all of financial regulations under one agency. Any sign that Timothy Geithner or Barney Frank are interested in this at all?
No, there's not any indication of that, but I do think lawmakers will probably ask about that this morning, since that stands to be a big proposal out of the Senate. And even if it's not in the House bill, if it's in the Senate bill, you know, the two sides of Congress may have to meet some kind of agreement. So that's going to be a new topic on the House side. It hasn't really come up in the House before. And it probably will be controversial.
All right. Well, the regulatory dramas continue down on Capitol Hill. Louise Story in Washington, New York Times finance reporter. Thanks, Louise.
Thanks.
And our final takeout comes from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor here in the studio. So We've got the college football season, which is well underway, and the rankings now actually have some data to support them. But suddenly, college football upsets creates some mathematical problems in the rankings. This is a big controversy. Explain.
Well, okay, so I want to get to some of the most exciting stories of the season right now. You have Javed Best, who plays for Cal, who Javed Best scored 5 touchdowns last game. Cal is undefeated. Well, they're undefeated so far. They're about to get into Pac-10 play. They're a great team to watch
Cal
for.
Cal Davis? The Bears?
Berkeley Cal.
Oh, the exactly. Berkeley Cal.
Yeah, exactly.
I think our producer, Colin, will freak out.
Well, I think – so I want people to look out for them. Also, remember that guy Sam Bradford who played for Oklahoma that went down early in the season? And
yep.
It was a big hoopla over him.
Yep.
Well, this guy, Landry Jones, who took his place, just scored a Oklahoma record 6 touchdowns in the last game. So he's come on, and we'll see if we need Sam Bradford. Oklahoma's not ranked in the top 10.
Heisman shortlist?
He's not on the shortlist yet, but he's definitely – he's going to get some mention. That's an interesting point. And then there's also Chad Jones for LSU. Chad Jones played for the LSU's College World Series winning baseball team. Now he just had 2 interceptions last week. So there's some interesting stories.
All right, here is the upset that's really sort of tipped over the apple cart in the college rankings.
McKnight trying to throw a block. Ball is up. Still running. Flag is down. That's it anywhere. Huskies upset the Trojans here in Seattle.
Who would have thunk it? The Washington Huskies upset USC. What's that going to mean?
And this is why I focused on Cal today, University of California at Berkeley, because the Pac-10 is a really difficult conference. If you lose a game in that conference, you're gonna lose your chances to get a national championship. USC has now gotten bumped out like we just listened to. I don't know if USC is going to be able to come back from that and be able to compete for the national championships.
But it still means, in terms of absolute performance, the rankings are messed up because you might actually have everybody in the Pac-10 in the top 10.
Without a doubt. And that's partly because the teams are so good. It's the same thing with the Big Ten, the same thing with the Southeast Conference, the SEC. So, you'll get a team like last year, Florida. They lost the game, and they still were able to win the national championship. So there's a chance if your schedule's tough enough, and that's really about what it's about in college football. Look at your team, look at what their ranking is, and then look at their schedule for the rest of the year, and then you'll determine how they're going to end up.
Look at Celeste's team, University of Michigan, where they stand. Just give her some encouragement.
They're doing good, you know. Better than they were
in the
last year.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks for that takeout. Takeaway sports contributor here in the studio. Thanks.
Good morning.
Coming up, how a suspected terror case is creating tension between the NYPD and the FBI. We're also talking about the ugly American. Is that reality or a myth? And what are the traits of an ugly American?
This is Richard Cavish up in Nyack. I think one reason why so many foreigners regard Americans as ugly is that we go over to Europe, to places like France and Germany, and just walk into restaurants and stores and speak English and make no attempt at all to speak foreign languages.
Parlez-vous American?
That's
Tell
great.
Us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
That was ugly.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, folks, the challenges of warning and securing a big city in the age of Al-Qaeda. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But here are some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. Later this morning, President Obama speaks to the full UN General Assembly in New York. He meets with Japan's new prime minister next hour. And the rains are starting to ease in Georgia. They're happy about that. The southeast is badly in need of relief from floods that have already killed 10 people. The deep waters have caused some hundreds of millions of dollars in damage.
U.S. authorities shut down a busy border crossing with Mexico after federal agents fired on 3 vans driven by apparent human traffickers. The drivers tried to zoom past the inspectors there. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says he'll request leniency for 3 American hikers detained after straying into Iranian territory in July. He's in New York for the UN meeting. And finally, in baseball, the New York Yankees are the first team to clinch a spot in the playoffs. They beat the LA Angels last night. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Well, we've certainly been following all week the stories that we woke up to on Sunday morning. People learned of terrorist arrests in Denver and New York. And as the week progressed, we've learned more details about the plot that the federal investigators and New York City investigators are looking into. And it raises an issue. How do you warn residents of a city and how do you reassure them at the same time? Here's Police Commissioner Ray Kelly with that contradictory tone.
We have not engaged in any different practices or increased our security. As I say, we do a lot every day. We devote 1,000 police officers, actually over 1,000 police officers every day, to protect this city from a terrorist threat. We have not increased those that number of resources.
So there is a threat. There isn't a threat. We do have arrests, but we're not doing anything different. We do have to be more vigilant. The contradictory messages emerge every time there are one of these arrests and investigations. Here to talk about the details of these latest plots from arrests in Colorado and New York, as we've said, investigators are looking into, and the nature of what the public is supposed to do in response. We've got Christopher Dickey here, Newsweek's Middle East regional editor. He's the author of Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. He's in Paris. Christopher Dickey, good morning.
Hi, good morning, John.
And Lydia Khalil, former counterterrorism analyst at the NYPD and international affairs fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, joins us from New York. Good morning, Lydia.
Good morning.
First of all, Christopher, let's talk about the details of these plots, which actually are disturbing and are reminiscent of some other targeting of transit systems around the world, including Spain and London. What do we know?
Well, there's a lot of suspicious activity. The first thing we know is that the key figure in this, Najibullah Zazi, the 24-year-old Afghan, has been back and forth to the tribal areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan a couple of times in the last couple of years. There are three kind of plots that the police really worry about. One is an al-Qaeda core plot where you got bin Laden giving orders saying, you know, try and blow up big buildings. Another is the homegrown plot like the Herald Square bombers back in 2004, who really are pretty ineffectual but are still potentially dangerous. But since the London bombings and since Madrid, the biggest worry often is homegrown plots where people connect with people in Pakistan or Afghanistan who can show them how to make real bombs. That's what happened in London in July of 2005, and that's clearly what they were afraid was going to happen here, especially when they started to find that a lot of backpacks had been acquired, the kinds of things that you leave lying around on subway cars or train cars. That's exactly what happened in Madrid. It wasn't even a suicide bombing, but almost 200 people were killed.
Well, Lydia Khalil, the challenge for urban areas then is not to simply wait for the backpacks to show up and try to assemble countermeasures at that point, but you really need to have cops on the beat in Peshawar, correct?
In a way, yes. You know, the New York Police Department has been very, very proactive in facing these kind of threats. And not only in the New York City, but they've extended their reach abroad as well. They do that by having intelligence liaisons overseas, and they try to get plugged into the threat before it manifests itself out in New York City.
Now, you know, this week we've got the United Nations meeting, and I'm wondering if this case really sets up the classic competitive posture between an organization like the FBI, an investigative organization, and the NYPD, which really has its major responsibility to protect the citizens of New York. Christopher Dickey, the NYPD felt that it had to move and do the arrests that it undertook over the weekend because it was worried about these attacks possibly being timed for the UN meetings here. But is that an appropriate response, and does the FBI have a point that maybe the NYPD should have waited?
Well, this is not entirely clear who did what, when, and for what reasons, but it used to be thought that you either had law enforcement trying to prosecute terrorists and criminals after the fact, which certainly after 9/11 wasn't good enough, or you had intelligence agencies that just like to sort of watch what's happening, and they let things play out sort of endlessly. But there's a third option, and that's to disrupt plots. And the intelligence division of the NYPD traditionally has put its focus on disrupting plots. It spots people that it thinks may be involved in a plot, and it goes after them to intimidate them, to recruit them, and only very rarely to try and arrest and convict them. Mm. Whether that was what was going on here isn't completely clear, but they have a long record of doing that, and the FBI seems to have had a slightly different idea of how it wanted to pursue the case.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East regional editor. He's the author of Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. So Lydia Khalil, former counterterrorism analyst at the NYPD, that's a frightening trade-off. Do you disrupt, or do you arrest, or do you wait for the really big fish? And we should sort of grisly remind people that the London investigators really got some big fish after those horrible attacks in London, but it doesn't make people in London feel any better, right, Lydia?
Exactly. It's always a trade-off that law enforcement and intelligence officials have to deal with. But in this particular case, it seems like it was a matter of crossed wires between the FBI and the NYPD. both organizations were working with different informants, and it seems like an NYPD informant tipped off the main suspect in this case, Zazi, and which is why the arrests had to be moved up a little bit. Normally, I think even the NYPD Intelligence Division, as Mr. Dickey said, is very proactive, would have probably waited a little bit longer to conduct these arrests had it not been for these cross wires and this tip-off. Now, we're never going to know just exactly how big this case is because of this early arrest, and we're never going to know exactly who else may be involved. So this early arrest presents us with a problem in terms of outlining the scope of this case and what the actual threat is.
Christopher Dickey, are the protocols worked out of how an NYPD shares information with an FBI, if they're using different informants, or how an FBI alerts an NYPD?
Oh, well, they're supposed to be, but no, they're not that well worked out. There's been a lot of tension over time. It's supposed to be better now. They always say it's better than it was. But David Cohen, who's the head of the Intelligence Division for the NYPD, famously tells his people there's no such thing as sharing intelligence. There's only trading intelligence.
Oh, that's rich. Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor and author of Securing the City Inside America's Best Counterterrorism Force, the NYPD. And Lydia Khalil, former counterterrorism analyst at the NYPD. She's also a fellow in international affairs at the Council on Foreign Relations. Coming up, Celeste, how many web servers does it take to make a grilled cheese sandwich? It's a practical issue, and it's going on our website.
One to work the mouse and one to tweet about it.
What's your secret at 877-8-MY-TAKE? And we'll talk more in 10 minutes. That was good.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. Well, if the 80s are all just a blur to you, maybe you forgot that the movie Flashdance was placed in Pittsburgh. She was a welder by day and had dancing aspirations. And just like the movie's lead character, the city has now shed its blue-collar threads for something quite a bit more glamorous. This week, Pittsburgh plays host to world leaders as the site of the G20 Economic Summit.
Disco Summit, we'll call it. The G20 Disco.
That's really a stretch, John. Tony Norman has lived through the city's ups and downs. He's a columnist and associate editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Tony, good morning. What was your reaction when you heard that the G20 summit was coming to town?
Well, quite frankly, I was incredulous, Celeste. I mean, because we're the largest of small towns, and as a result, we have something of an inferiority complex when it comes to these fancy things. I mean, a G20 summit here in Pittsburgh, we pronounce it Pix, as in P-I-K-S-Burg. So, we were quite stunned by this.
I spent a long time in Detroit, so I know something about inferiority complexes for the Rust Belt cities. Have you heard reports or reviews in the news from people who are surprised that Pittsburgh got the G20 summit?
Oh, yes. Everyone's surprised, including the protesters, because, they prepare long and hard for these conferences in glamorous places like London and Helsinki or wherever. And then what do you do in Pittsburgh other than, what do you threaten to overturn, pierogi trucks or what?
So, you walk up some serious hills if you're a protester, that's
right.
For sure.
That's for sure.
On one level, Tony, the home of Andrew Carnegie. And
yeah.
Andrew Mellon is, in some ways, if you look at the long history of Pittsburgh, a pretty good place to have a meeting of global capitalists.
It certainly is, but, how many people have that kind of perspective? I mean, most people are ahistorical. I mean, that would be a perfect reason for having it here because, obviously, according to a lot of the protesters, this is a meeting of plutocrats, and that's exactly why they want to disrupt it. On the other hand, the city wants to put its best face forward.
And speaking of the best face forward, what have you seen? What kind of preparations has Pittsburgh been making?
Well, it's like any city that's expecting, the apocalypse any minute. The bulwarks are out. The police are somewhat overreacting to some of the smallest provocations. There, the streets downtown are emptying by the day. I mean, tomorrow is just going to be impossible to get to and from work if your place of employment is even open downtown.
Tony,
so it's gonna be a ghost town.
If you're a plutocrat, do you get a discount on pierogies?
Ha ha ha! You already own the pierogies if you're a plutocrat.
You know? Tony, you've been there for 20 years.
Right, about 21 years. Actually,
21 years. So you've seen a big change in Pittsburgh. Is this the zenith of Pittsburgh's? Is this the height of its ambitions here, or has it got further to go?
I think Pittsburgh wants to be New York. That would be the zenith, the heights of his ambitions. But it will never get there. But in the meantime, it will certainly be a pleasant place. And if we can get through this conference, you know, with our soul intact, without violating too many civil rights or getting trashed by the protesters, we'll be pretty happy. I mean, our ambitions are at that point.
Tony Norman, not violating civil rights in Pittsburgh. He's the associate editor and columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. So if 1,000 people showed up in your kitchen to tweak your recipes while you were cooking, would that be a help to you?
I don't think my kitchen can fit 1,000 people.
Well, maybe in the age of social networking, there's a way to get 1,000 people in on your cooking act. Coming up, we're going to talk about that. We're also talking about the ugly American. President Obama is certainly not an ugly American. He's trying to improve the USA's image in front of world leaders. But is the ugly American a myth?
This is Heidi Porch from Salt Lake City, Utah. Pretty much an ugly American is someone, even in the United States, it's a tourist who is very demanding and really overly aggressive about what they think they deserve while they're on vacation.
Call us with what you think are the traits of an ugly American, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, we've got some news stories we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama will try to fight that ugly American image we've been talking about in a speech to the full UN General Assembly. And next hour, he's going to meet with Japan's new prime minister. President Obama's efforts yesterday on Middle East peace are getting good reviews from Israel anyway. The U.S. apparently lowered the bar on demands that Israel halt settlement building before peace talks with Palestinians.
10 are now dead in the floods covering Georgia and other parts of the southeast. Damages are estimated in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Rains are expected to ease today, though. Sarah Palin is abroad today. In her first trip to Asia, she addressed Hong Kong investors in a paid speech.
And those are some of the stories that we are following this morning. Talking about food on Wednesday morning, and it had to happen, I guess, in the age of social networking, the idea of wiki cuisine, where people can all share their not only recipes, but their specific ideas and ingredients in an individual recipe, pushing the notion of too many cooks in the kitchen to its digital limit. And to talk about that, we've got Kim Severson, Takeaway contributor, who writes about food for the New York Times, right here in the studio. Good morning, Kim.
Hi.
And Barnaby Dorfman is founder and CEO of Foodista.com. It's an online cooking encyclopedia that anyone can edit. Barnaby, good morning.
Good morning.
And I have to say, as a cook, the idea of wiki cuisine, composite sort of multiple edited, many, many cooks editing one recipe, seems like an unworkable idea. What's happened in your experience?
Well, we find that it works great. I think, you know, first of all, it's not that, you know, thousands of people edit one recipe typically. People contribute small amounts to a lot of different recipes. But it's really leveraging this new medium in a way that is very different from print. If you think about print, when you print a recipe in a book or a newspaper, it can never change. It's fixed. And there's always a cost to making that next copy. Every copy you make costs something. Whereas online, it's free to make that next copy, and things can evolve and change. And so if you work back from that sort of those constraints with print, you have to have an editor. You have to have a select few group of people who are writing because it's expensive to get it out there, and again, it has to be accurate. Whereas on the web, we can open up and we can let people contribute their version of a recipe, and it can be, you know, my twist on a recipe, and it can be a completely different recipe, or it can be somebody helping with the editorial process,
right,
correcting spelling errors and just making things better.
Well, and we've been testing this concept a little bit with a simple recipe for a grilled cheese sandwich, all right? We're starting with bread and cheese. What would you folks add? How would you cook it? Go to thetakeaway.org. We've gotten zillions of comments already. 10 Miss says Jewish rye, baby spinach, any available mustard. Linda says, I cookie cut my grilled cheese sandwiches to look like the Virgin Mary. Kim Severson, what's going on here? Is this a social revolution in cooking and a recipe sharing?
Well, I don't know if it's a social revolution. I think people love cooking and they want to cook together. There's this idea of group cooking, but I think there's a point at which too many cooks are a problem in the kitchen. I like a really reliable recipe. I like a recipe I know I can cook with. I spend a lot of money with my ingredients. It takes time. A lot of us aren't cooking as much. So when I go into the kitchen, I want a trusted source and a point of view. I want to know that, you know, that $30, $40 I just spent on ingredients aren't going to be wasted. I'm not sure I want every Yahoo who thinks they can cook giving me an opinion.
Yahoo. I think that might be a little offensive. Barnaby, there are no Yahoos on your side, yeah. Are there?
Oh, I'm sure there are. There's a whole spectrum of people. But, you know, cooking is fundamentally social, and I cook a lot, too. And I think I take a slightly different approach. I love to read a lot of different recipes. I had a large cookbook collection. I love cookbooks. But if I'm making something new, I'll try to read, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 different recipes. And out of that, I'll cull the ideas that make sense to me, you know, from well-known authors. But again, at the end of the day, it's my creation. And this is just taking that to a much, much larger scale.
You know, Celeste, we noticed this just talking in the office. But, Kim, I wonder if you've been aware of this at all. There's something really intuitive about the idea that a conversation starts around a particular recipe. I was talking to my kids last night.
Right.
My daughter Olivia makes a grilled cheese sandwich by brushing it with butter and putting it in aluminum foil. She says, you have to put it in aluminum foil, Daddy, and cook it on a very, very hot skillet. My mother says grilled cheese sandwich. Now, I like open-faced cheese sandwiches. Put the cheese on top of the bread, put it under the broiler with a little Worcestershire sauce and ketchup and a little bacon on top. So there's diversity there. You can't combine those recipes, but you can certainly have a conversation, right, Kim?
I mean, that's the idea. Is there only one kind of recipe? Is there one perfect apple pie recipe? Is there one perfect grilled cheese recipe? And I think some of the idea behind the Wiki model is that if you got enough collective opinion, you would come up with a very good workable formula to make an apple pie, and that's probably true. However, you'll see the joy of cooking, the fun of it, and the impossibility of making it work, I think, in a true Wiki way, is that it's such an individual pursuit. You and I, all three of us sitting here, could make an entirely different sandwich, and that's kind of the beauty of the kitchen. You know, recipes are not facts, they're formulas, they're interpretations, they're guides to some larger creative pursuit. Although, I have to say, there is something about this conversation about food. And that's a great thing about writing about food. I can have a conversation about any topic through food, as you'll see. So
right.
I think there's something people want to talk, and increasingly they want to talk about food and be in the kitchen.
Celeste, does Grant have a grilled cheese recipe, son?
He does. We also brush the melted butter on there, but he thinks a grilled cheese should have very sharp cheddar and pepper jack, and he eschews mention of American cheese on a grilled cheese sandwich. That is that is not a real grilled cheese.
Tara writes on thetakeaway.org, open-faced English muffin, grilled cheese. Grate some good cheddar, one slice of tomato on each half of muffin. Sprinkle the cheddar on top of the tomatoes. Add several drops of Worcestershire sauce. Place both in a toaster and toast until brown. Do you have any suggestions, Barnaby?
Well, I think I'm with your mother. I really like the recipe that you described. But, it's early for us, and we haven't exactly figured out where the dividing line is between a new recipe that's different and kind of a core, this is the one that everybody should make. But I love the way you describe it as a conversation. It's a starting place. The other thing that we try to bring to it is really addressing categories that are hard to find information on. And so, you know, we're focused on the grilled cheese sandwich in this conversation. Everybody knows what a grilled cheese sandwich is or has some experience with it. But, you know, we have all also had the experience of walking around in the supermarket and finding an ingredient or a food that we've never seen before and we don't know how to cook and we don't know what to do with. And it's hard to find a single cookbook that's got everything. And so this lets you basically share that knowledge and go to a single place and find out how to cook Malabar spinach or something that maybe you've never seen before.
But I guess if Stephen Colbert finds out about the foodista.com, he'll get on your site and put like 4 cups of salt in every sort of recipe. I mean, how do you keep from people who want to sabotage the process?
Well, it's a community. I mean, it's like society as a whole. Society works pretty well because people interact with each other, and there's feedback, and if somebody sees that, you know, there's a lot of transparency on our site and most wiki-based sites. You can see who's edited what, when, and if somebody does something like that, you can revert it. You can change it back to the way it was or edit it. And so
food policeman.
It's really a reflection of society in general, I think.
Kim Severson, final thought?
Well, I think that the fact of the matter is we all want to cook, and the more recipes, the better. I maintain that a point of view is a very important thing in the kitchen. Make sure your recipe is tested, but I just say go and cook.
Go and cook with 1,000 of your best friends. That's right. Kim Severson, takeaway contributor who writes about food for the New York Times, and Barnaby Dorfman, founder and CEO of Foodista.com, an online cooking encyclopedia, that recipe website that anyone can edit. If you want the spelling of Foodista.com, go to our website.
Let's have 1,000 people help me decide what to have for lunch today. I'm sure you can help us out. Give us your tips, actually, on making a grilled cheese sandwich. That would make a good lunch. You can reach us at 8778-MYTAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We've gotten a lot of recipes so far. They're very varied at thetakeaway.org. There's actually a lot of conversations going on the website, John. You remember yesterday we talked with Kristen Rouse, First Lieutenant in the Army National Guard, about the war in Afghanistan. Someone wrote, just what Lieutenant Rouse means by moral obligation to the Afghan people is really not made clear in this conversation. And Kristen writes back, the moral obligation I'm talking about is to do good and genuinely assist a war-torn nation to recover from its recent past. Why don't you weigh in as well? Go to thetakeaway.org. And we're getting help on what is an ugly American. President Obama is talking before world leaders at the UN General Assembly, trying to improve America's rep. What is an ugly American?
This is Naomi Ruth from Detroit, Michigan. I think people worldwide think Americans are so ugly because we're so loud. I think people don't understand how loud they're speaking in public, and that everybody doesn't want to hear their life story.
We want to hear yours at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
First, there was the Cold War.
A day of high drama and momentous events in the current historic session of the United Nations.
Well, no one got buried by communism, but the Cold War has been replaced by a superpower conflict over global warmth. And everyone could be underwater if leaders don't act.
Our generation's response to this challenge will be judged by history. For if we fail to meet it boldly, swiftly, and together, we risk consigning future generations to an irreversible catastrophe. We share the same biology, regardless of
ideology. Believe me when I say to you. Believe it, folks. At the United Nations, the U.S. and China are competing to confront climate change. That's your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 23rd. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley.
Good morning, John. This hour, we're going to go to Georgia, get an update on the floods there and what the kind of damage they've caused. And we'll meet some hilarious protesters. Crowdsourcing a grilled cheese sandwich, is that a good idea? Some people on the website say so. We'll see what you and other takeaway listeners come up with in our online experiment.
Right now, the Cold War, or a Cold War on Global Warmth. Taya Smith joins us. She's an expert on China's climate and energy policy at the Carnegie Endowment. Taya, is there a global warmth war between the U.S. and China?
Well, the U.S. and China have plenty of competing interests, but as we're seeing through climate change, we've also got an increasing number of shared interests. And right now, it's the places where we have competition that are actually going to drive both of our countries to do more and tackle climate change with more energy than we have in the past.
Competition is a good thing. That's the takeaway. We're going to talk more with Taya Smith in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, global warming, John, is just one of the topics on the president's agenda today. He's going to talk about that and more in his UN speech next hour. And this hour, he's meeting with Japan's new prime minister. Our partner, the New York Times, reports President Obama is considering alternatives to sending more troops to Afghanistan. One of the plans would reduce the number of U.S. troops there. It would focus more on rooting out al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Good news for the southeast. Rains are slowing, but whole communities are still underwater. Floods there have killed 10, mostly in Georgia. The deep waters have done hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. They'd love more rain in Southern California, where thousands of acres are burning. Firefighters are battling a wildfire in Ventura County, not far from Los Angeles. Many homes are under threat. And in Washington, the Federal Reserve isn't expected to move interest rates today, but investors will comb through that Fed statement at about 2:15 this afternoon to see what's coming. Today, the Fed wraps up 2 days of meetings. Markets are waiting for the Fed. They edged up yesterday. The Dow opens this morning at 98.30, the S&P at 10.72, the NASDAQ begins at 21.46. So the ugly American, is that reality or a myth in the age of Barack Obama, who speaks before the UN General Assembly later today? Do ugly Americans get a makeover in the 21st century, or maybe...
I love you just the way you are.
Billy Joel, there's an ugly American. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What is an ugly American?
That's John Hockenberry, WNC.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. At the United Nations yesterday, we expected to hear some pretty significant things from China's Hu Jintao and our own president, and we did hear some bold pronouncements from Obama.
Difficulty is no excuse for complacency. Unease is no excuse for inaction. And we must not allow the perfect to become the enemy of progress.
Bold words, but very few specifics. Chinese President Hu Jintao took to the podium to declare his nation's intentions to reduce emissions, get this, by a notable margin. Not really sure what that means. So I'm going to ask Taya Smith. She's an expert on
Chinese climate and
environmental policy at the Carnegie Endowment. Duly noted, John. Good morning, Taya. You join us from Washington. What does that mean, a notable margin?
Well, good morning. We are not clear right now what is meant by notable margin. Essentially, what he said is that China will reduce the amount of carbon emitted that it uses to produce a dollar's worth of gross domestic product. And what that means is that you could have an overall rise in carbon emissions, but that the intensity of the carbon emissions would decrease for every dollar of GDP.
There was a lot of expectations about Hu Jintao's speech. I mean, the UN chief of energy said that China could come forward as a front runner on climate change, but we didn't hear any specifics about what China is going to do, and I guess many people expected some specifics. Was the speech was it still significant?
It was very significant in that it was the first time a Chinese official anywhere close to President Hu's level, and he is the highest ranked official in China, had stated that his government was focused on climate change, that they took it seriously, and that they were going to be taking actions to reduce China's carbon emissions. So he said they were going to be reducing the intensity, dollar for dollar, of GDP. But he also said they were going to increase the forest coverage by sort of close to 100 million acres and increase their use of non-fossil fuels by 15% of the power by 2020. So a lot of specifics that allow us to really take something from it for our work with Congress, but
or
it
hold
is
them
something
accountable.
Important.
Yeah, or hold them accountable. Well, one of the things that we've been talking about is this global warmth war between China and the United States, and President Obama talked about taking the lead on some renewable energy sources. We're joined by Henrik Fleischer. He's the CEO of Sargas, and you announced a demonstration project yesterday. You're actually working in conjunction with Chinese industry on a project.
Well, not quite there yet, but I mean, we have started our demo project. We are capturing 98% of the CO2 from a coal-fired power plant, and we think that all of this equipment can be made available also for the Chinese industry, which, of course, certainly is fired on coal, too.
But the big question, I mean, one of the things that China has a history of doing is reverse engineering and grabbing technology, manufacturing some of these things themselves, and then saying we don't need the product from another country. Are you worried about that?
Of course, that is a concern of many Western countries going there. But on the other hand, I think this problem is big enough so that if you go on the right footing to China, I'm sorry, it can be sorted out. And if you work with the right type of parties, as everywhere else in the world, you have to work with the right type of people.
Well, Taya was saying that we don't know what notable margin means, which is what Hu Jintao talked about yesterday. Henrik Fletcher, do you know what notable margin means? I mean, can your technology achieve a notable margin of reduction in CO2 emissions?
Yes, it can. I think that the problem for many of these leaders is that so far these technologies haven't been available. So they, too, don't even know what their margin is. But the fact is that if you want to limit to two degrees global warming, you need to do something with the existing coal-fired power plants throughout the world. There are more than 5,000 of them emitting more than 3 million tons per year. You need to do something with them. You need to repower them and retrofit with capture equipment. That I would call a notable margin.
So you see China, your company is based in Norway. Do you see China as a large potential market?
The Chinese are opening a coal-fired power plant almost every 5 days. China is fired on coal. America is firing coal. And yes, these markets are very large markets for companies like ours.
So, Taya, what did you take away from Hu Jintao's speech yesterday as compared with what President Obama had to say? Do you feel like these two countries are serious about moving forward and where they're actually going to be able to get some of these things passed in there once they get back to their home country?
Well, it's really all about the details. So what we heard from yesterday was that both of the countries are focused on climate change, are focused on the aspects of economic growth that climate change addresses or interferes with. And so now the question is, can they turn that into some details that are going to satisfy the people of both countries?
That's a big question, actually. Taya Smith, expert on China's climate and energy policy at the Carnegie Endowment in Washington, D.C. Henrik Fletcher, CEO of Sargas, thank you both for joining us. He joined us from Pittsburgh.
For the rest of the segment, we're going to talk with Andrew Revkin, who's the New York Times environmental reporter. He's here in the studio to help us explain something which may actually put the lie to the assumption that we have, first of all, that the debate over global warming is settled, number one, and number two, that global warming consists of a kind of a calm, easy, but disturbing incremental increase degree by degree in temperature around the world. In fact, climate stability is maybe a more germane issue here. Andrew Revkin, if you don't have climate stability around the world, you can't predict that spring's going to be in April. You can't predict the rainfall, so that complicates agriculture. Climate stability, the loss of climate stability, has enormous global implications.
It does, and actually another issue is the lack of predictability. That actually affects these negotiations. I just was at the UN yesterday talking with the head environment minister from India. He's their negotiator. He said, you know, we still don't know what's going to happen with the monsoon. So minor question, what's going to happen with the source of rain? That's 45% of India's GDP is dependent on rainfall, he told me. So, and we don't know. So it could get bigger, smaller, more flooding, less flooding. That creates lots of issues as well. It's the details of climate change matter way more than the long-term prognosis if you're in India or Siberia or whatever.
So it's wrong and maybe a distortion to focus on these global averages when we should really be looking at regional distortions and what that's going to mean to the global political system and the global economy.
What you're seeing now, I've been covering global warming since the 80s, and the old question was, are we changing climate? That's an old question now. That's been answered by all these scientific authorities. That leaves the much harder questions now, which is, what do we do and where? And I've been writing a lot on .earth, my blog, and in the paper recently about the reality is that it gets a lot tougher, a lot quicker. We've had a quiescent set of hurricane seasons recently. You know, the long-term prognosis is stronger hurricanes. So some of this actually sets a backdrop for these talks. Although, as everyone was saying before, the real questions are money questions. What you didn't hear a few minutes ago in the discussion about China is who's going to pay for that new technology.
Right.
And as I've written just the last couple of days, that's the heart of this issue.
And the money doesn't necessarily chase the crisis. Bangladesh has terrible problems with flooding as a result of global warming. The president of the Maldives yesterday stood up at the United Nations, or maybe it was earlier in the week, and said, we're going underwater, folks. Somebody help us out. That's a huge issue. But also the reduction of climate stability provides an argument for anti-global warming activists who say, hey, over here it's getting colder. What are you talking about? Global warming. How does that create problems?
Oh, my God. Well, the big issue, of course, for President Obama in a setting like yesterday, and the reason there was a lot of voices of disappointment is because an American president is shackled by the reality that if you want to have a treaty, if you want the United States to get involved with a treaty, it needs two-thirds Senate approval. So, the health care bill is 60 votes. This is 67 votes. So even with a strong Democratic majority, he is literally shackled by that reality. And the Indian environment minister, actually, and it's something I'll be writing for the blog later today, said, India and the United States are very different than China and all these other countries. We're raucous democracies, and we're hampered by that reality. So that's going to be an issue right through December in Copenhagen.
But that's the question. Is the United States going to be able to bring something concrete to Copenhagen, or is the U.S. lack of ability to do that going to kind of pull that deal apart?
Well, what you're seeing now is the realities around what can come out of Copenhagen are settling in. There was a lot of talk 2 years ago in Bali at the last big round of these talks about a deadline for the next big grand cosmic agreement. But those who really understand this decades-long process knew that was probably unrealistic from the get-go. So in Copenhagen, you'll see more steps toward...
In December.
More agreements. The big challenge will be, you'll see a lot of talk like what India is doing, saying, we're going to do these things domestically. We're not going to get locked in, India or China, under a treaty to any binding obligation. And Obama's people are pretty clear. They recognize in a very pragmatic way what's realistic. And they've been saying that all along.
So, Andrew Revkin, the takeaway here as we head to Copenhagen later on in the year is all climate change is local.
Yeah.
Andrew Revkin, New York Times environmental reporter and writer of the blog .earth on the New York Times, a blog about humans and their effect on the planet, good and bad. Coming up, we'll check in on the damage caused by flooding in the southeast with 9 deaths in Georgia and Alabama. More details coming up in the hour. And we'll go to Capitol Hill, where our D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick talks about what Congress is doing, not on health care, but on the war in Afghanistan. Troop increase in Afghanistan, Congress wants to weigh in on that, and we'll weigh in on it in a few minutes.
Call us now with your thoughts on the news at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253.
Good morning, everyone. In this segment, some quick takeouts on stories from correspondents around the country who are following stories that we want to stay absolutely current on. Our man on the Hill, Todd Zwillick, joins us now, takeaway contributor. Todd, in the middle of the healthcare debate, it appears a tactical shift is underway that might preempt Barack Obama's consideration of a different strategy in the Afghanistan war. What's going on, Todd?
Well, back in March, back in March, the president said Afghanistan is the central front in the war on terror, that winning in Afghanistan was key to protecting the United States. And then on Sunday, when he did that blitz on the Sunday shows, the president said he's not going to agree to any troop increases, even though that's apparently what the generals want, what Stanley McChrystal wants, until he can work out a strategy. That has reached Capitol Hill. And listen to Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican on the Armed Services Committee. I had an interview with him yesterday. Listen to this response.
Sunday threw me for a loop. I don't know how to absorb what he said Sunday with what he said March. And what has changed? The only thing that I can tell you between March and now is the urgency of the troops is greater. As the time from March to now has passed, we've lost more ground.
John, word from the White House is that the president now wants to consider what amounts to a counterterrorism strategy. Republicans on the Hill are livid. They want a counterinsurgency strategy, and they might want to take votes on that coming up in the next couple of weeks to challenge the president.
And you've also got Carl Levin opposed to a troop increase on the Democratic side, so there's a lot of pushback on different sides here.
There's a lot of pushback. And simmering in the background of the health debate, John, is an appropriations bill for the Pentagon. And that's a great way for Republicans like Lindsey Graham to come down on the war in Afghanistan and start to try to pressure the White House. Here's a sense of how he's thinking about how they want to approach this and try to get the president to maybe not go the route that we're hearing about this morning.
We have an obligation to deal with to take care of the ones that are there. They need to either be coming home or they need help, because leaving them there is not the right strategy. Nobody believes that leaving 68,000 people with the current dynamic is the right strategy.
All right, that's telling you that senators like Lindsey Graham are going to probably rebel if the White House comes down and says, well, we want to scale back in Afghanistan, but not increase troops, maybe scale back a little bit, just hit the terrorists. That's going to cause some problems on the Hill, especially with Republicans like Graham.
Afghanistan possibly complicating issues, conditional issues on the health care debate. It's a complicated mix. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, back for the second half. Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So, talking baseball today, a very exciting pennant race between the Tigers, the Detroit Tigers, and the Minnesota Twins. Well, I have my own opinions, but which team do you think has the better chance?
Well, I will say that the Tigers right now aren't playing the best baseball, but they're playing good baseball, and they're playing good enough baseball to win.
That's charitable.
This week, they have challenges coming up with Cleveland and Chicago, which they should beat, which are divisional players that they have to beat. But then they end off with a three-game homestand against the Minnesota Twins. So it could be decided literally at home, and it could push it to an extra season playoff game in between the playoffs. So it could be decided next week in a one-off game.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. Have you changed your mind about Joe Mauer as the MVP?
If the Twins are able to push this out, there's no question in my mind that Joe Mauer should be the MVP of the AL.
But you've also got Teixeira with the Yankees, who's a strong candidate. They're even talking Jeter.
Jeter is definitely the inspirational, spiritual favorite of the AL. So I'm always going to root for him. Exactly.
He's the spiritual. Well, how about the National League wild card? How do you see that playing out? There's four teams we've got here. The Colorado Rockies, we've got the San Francisco Giants, the Atlanta Braves, and the Florida Marlins as well.
The Rockies are definitely in the driver's seat with this one. But let's look at the Atlanta Braves and look at their schedule in the coming week. They're going to play the Mets, who they should easily beat, and they're going to play the Nationals, who they should easily beat. Then coming up is another interesting matchup where they play at Florida. They both are five games out. So next week you can have three games that the whole National League wild card could be decided in those three games.
Wow, and you've got the series between the Yankees and the Red Sox, which suddenly looks meaningful all of a sudden this weekend.
Yeah, this weekend the drama should be huge for that. That's a lot of playoff implications to see, you know, who the matchup's going to be, who the pitcher's going to be. It's going to be a great series.
Okay, and the start of the conference championships in the NBA, WNBA, anything to watch for there?
All roads through the Eastern Conference lead through Detroit when it comes to the WNBA. So
they're huge.
You have, the Indiana Fever are going to try their best, but they've lost 3 years in a row to the Detroit Shock. Yeah. And so this is going to be a great series. And in the Western Conference, you have the perennial stars of Lisa Leslie and versus Diana Taurasi. And if you remember Diana Taurasi, she played with UConn back in the day.
Sure.
Lisa Leslie, she's a future Hall of Famer. She's the anchor of the WNBA. So that's going to be the Los Angeles Sparks against the Phoenix Mercury. That's a great matchup in the West Conference.
I got three daughters, Ibrahim, and we've been dying to get them out to a WNBA game. Is it a great day at Madison Square Garden here in New York?
Ooh. Well, there's not really much going on in basketball in New York in general. It's a heartbreak.
But WNBA is a good ticket for three young girls.
Without a doubt. But I don't think you're going to get one here.
not going to get a champion here.
Yeah, not yet. Right. Not for a while. Right.
Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Thanks.
No, good morning, guys.
All right, so last takeout comes from you. We're talking about the ugly American. Is it a reality or a myth? President Obama is talking before the UN General Assembly. He's a popular international leader trying to improve our image. What are the traits of an ugly American? Peter emails us, as a very frequent international traveler, I thank goodness for the Chinese, Indians, and Russians. They're displacing Americans from the top of the ugly traveler heap. The stereotypical American traveler seems bumbling and lovable by comparison. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we've got a vigorous project going on at thetakeaway.org right now. On our website, we're curating a listener-generated recipe for grilled cheese sandwiches. It's got the essentials, the basic recipe, bread and cheese. We're asking you to add the ingredients. Just write them on the comments page. Bonus points, according to some, for being outlandish, although I say got to be practical here.
It
I'm a cook.
It needs to be edible.
Indeed, edible is important. A familiar voice called in with this.
Hi, this is Mickey Maynard, a Detroit correspondent for the New York Times and an occasional writer for the Times dining section. If you're going to fill a grilled cheese sandwich, something like sliced apple, tomato, or other vegetables, you have to warm the bread and cheese first. Enjoy.
All right, that's a good suggestion, because the temperature of the vegetables will keep it cold, and you don't want that. Chad says, while this cornerstone of American cuisine has been reinvented time and again to best experience the grilled cheese sandwich, one must keep it simple and keep it American. Plenty of butter, white bread, American cheese. I will add that I once had a deep-fried grilled cheese sandwich. That was amazing. But then again, anything deep-fried is pretty terrific.
That's
Linda
up for,
says...
That's up for argument.
I love this. I cookie-cut my grilled cheese sandwiches to look like the Virgin Mary. Whatever your suggestion is, give it to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org and join the fun.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll get an update on how people in the Southeast are surviving and the damage to their homes from the flood.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we'll go to Georgia, where floods have damaged homes throughout the Southeast. That's in just a moment. Right now, here are some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. Next hour, President Obama speaks to the full UN General Assembly in New York. Early excerpts of his speech show he'll challenge world leaders to step up rather than, quote, wait for America. This afternoon, President Obama meets with Russia's president.
Dramatic story in Southern California. U.S. authorities shut down a busy border crossing with Mexico after federal agents fired on three vans. The drivers, apparent human traffickers, tried to blow through the barricade. Today, the Senate Finance Committee is back at work on a health care overhaul bill from Chair Max Baucus. They're wading through hundreds of amendments to the bill. In Southern California, firefighters are battling a wildfire in Ventura County, not far from L.A. Thousands of acres are torched and many homes are right in the blaze's warpath. In baseball, the New York Yankees are the first team with a guaranteed playoff spot. They clinched last night, and those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Today, much of the Southeast, especially Georgia, is recuperating from some very heavy rains and floods that destroyed homes, cars, even took some lives. 10 people in Georgia and Alabama have been reported dead because of the flooding. Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue declared a state of emergency there and has asked the federal government for help.
I have transmitted a letter to the President of the United States asking for an emergency declaration.
Joining us with an update from Georgia is Susanna Capiluto. She's the news director for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Also with us is Angela Olson, whose house was damaged in the flooding in Georgia. Susanna, is there any more rain expected?
Seems like the rain is gone at least until the weekend. So we're sort of having a good dry spell that we all can use here.
So is the water subsiding?
It is starting to. There are still some rivers that are high in the suburbs of Atlanta and Cobb County. There are some bridges still out as the Chattahoochee River is basically, you know, at high levels. But it is it's subsiding, absolutely.
On the level of disasters here, we're more than 30,000 residents without power, 1,000 homes were flooded. They're talking about $250 million in damages. Where would you scale this? Is this a major disaster for the area?
It is a major disaster in some counties, for Cobb County and Douglas County. The city of Atlanta is quite okay because we're on a little higher ground, but it's those low-lying counties that are really hit hard where the rivers overflowed and the creeks overflowed, and they have a lot of damage. But all damage estimates are estimates at this time. They say it's going to be 3 days until they really know how bad the damage is.
So Angela Olson was in one of those areas that was hard hit, Ackworth, Georgia. Angela, your house was flooded by the rainstorms there, and you do not have flood insurance, correct?
No, I don't.
What did you do when the water started coming in? What kind of preparations did you take to kind of try to protect your house?
We got all the kids and a couple neighbors came down, and we started... because the underneath part of the house filled up, and it was probably 4 or 5 feet, maybe a little bit more. feet of water, and so we got down there with buckets, but it was just hopeless because it was coming down faster than you could actually get it out. So in order for it, otherwise it would have been in my house, everything would have been destroyed. So we started getting a pickaxe and a chisel, and we actually chiseled holes in the base of the house on the foundation so that it wouldn't compromise the house, and I probably would have been filled with water. So we actually made holes in the cement blocks to let the water come out of the house. And when it came out with so much pressure, there probably had to be a couple thousand gallons under the house.
So, Angela, you are an unemployed house painter, correct?
Yes.
And you have no flood insurance?
No, I can't afford it, and I know there's a lot more people probably sitting in the same situation because we've been really hit hard down here with this economy.
So you also just put in a brand new water heater that was destroyed. How are you going to repair the damages?
I have no idea. I have no AC that was just redone. I have no furnace now for the winter. I have no hot water, and that's where the main 220-volt cable runs up under the house. That soaks, so I don't have a kitchen stove or the microwave. That's all on the same electrical thing. So I'm just sitting here trying to figure out how I'm going to make it again.
This seems to me to be what's really complicating this flooding there in the area, is that, yes, it's a major disaster, but what's really making it difficult is you've got a lot of people who are hit in areas where they did not have flood insurance, and the bad economy means it's hitting people who can't afford to repair their homes.
A lot of the people down here have already made sacrifices. No cell phones. You figure that they cut cable TV, they don't go out. And since we're rural, if you do get a job, you have to spend a lot more in gas and to get there. And materials, the price for everything down here has gone up so high, you're lucky you can pay your bills or decide whether I'm going to eat or do I pay my bills? That's how bad it's been down here.
So, Susanna, is it maybe the state of the economy that's turning this into...
It's terrible because Georgia does not... It's our budget. The state budget is very depleted. So there is really no uninsured help fund, so to speak. So the governor has asked FEMA to come in and at least make, you know, loans available, you know, for people like Angela. And then... temporary housing. There's a lot of people, you know, that have to rent while maybe their houses get repaired. And there's literally a lot of people who don't have flood insurance. It's just not something you really think about, you know, in this area and a lot of these areas. And so that'll be the story that we'll be following, is what happens, you know, to people like Angela that really need the help. And that's why the governor has asked FEMA, but we haven't heard yet. FEMA is going to step up.
And the state fund, like many states, is depleted. So how much... how much of this damage can the state cover?
Very little. They say rescue efforts, of course. They're working with the Red Cross there. The Georgia Emergency Management Agency, of course, has a budget. But there is no fund for, like, uninsured help, to help people like Angela. The state just doesn't have that sort of money. FEMA sort of does. You know, they can make low-interest loans. They got a lot more money. So we're hoping that the president will say, yes, you know, FEMA can step in and help Georgia. But we haven't heard yet.
So, Angela, you live in the home with your family, including some younger kids. What are you planning to do, say, for the next week? How are you going to get through the next few days?
I'm not sure exactly, because I know now I'm with kids. You need to have at least a heating system for the winter, and the winter's coming on very fast, and I wouldn't worry about it in a normal economy. I'd have earned the money and put in a new heater and a new water heater, but if you can't earn your money, you can't pay your bills. and I'm getting a little bit desperate because I don't know what I'm going to do, because I know my boy decided he was going to take a bath last night, and it's like I said, you got to deal with the freezing water or warm it up on my propane stove that my sister brought to me and take a bath like that. Well, I have a water heater, but it doesn't work anymore. So
well, just be careful with that propane stove in the house heating up water like that. I don't know if I'd recommend that.
And best of luck to you, Angela Olson, her house was damaged in the flooding in Georgia. We also heard from Susanna Capelluto. She's the news director for Georgia Public Broadcasting. So, John, if you were going to protest something, what would you make a sign, a big poster?
Well, I'd march with a pitchfork. That'd be my style.
And a burning torch. Maybe you might plan a joke or a nice little magic trick. More on creative protest pranks and how effective they really are. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Did you know, John, that Taliban members actually have day jobs?
I am a civil servant. That's how I support my family, with my salary and by growing wheat. At the same time, I have been with the Taliban for about 2 years.
This man is what's being called a weekend jihadi. He's from Wardak province, a Taliban-controlled province west of Kabul.
It's like a Taliban National Guard or something?
Yeah, it's kind of like his weekend getaway to a certain extent. He didn't want to be identified, but of course he's a civil servant for the Afghan government during the week and then joins the Taliban on the weekends. So the United States is trying to work out a strategy on how to pursue the war in Afghanistan. Weekend jihadis are kind of blurring this line in terms of who is the target there. To find out more, we're going to speak with Kate Clark, a former BBC Kabul correspondent. Kate visited Afghanistan recently to investigate this phenomenon of the weekend jihadi. Kate, how widespread is this? Is this an isolated thing?
Well, I encountered it by chance. I'd gone to Afghanistan in the summer to talk to members of the Taliban about a different story, and I just uncovered this phenomena, which is extraordinary. Because you've got, there's parts of Wardak province, it's just to the west of Kabul, within commuting distance, which are under the control of the Taliban. And of course, if you've got your village there, you've got your farm there, you have to cross what feels like a front line to get to your job. But you've got your family, your farm back in Taliban areas. And to a certain extent, this is about people surviving a civil war. And it's something that's always gone on in Afghanistan. You put your eggs in different baskets. You work for the government, you go home and you support the people who are locally in power, which is the Taliban. But that there are sort of pragmatic issues, and there are also certainly people fighting because they feel strongly about the Taliban cause as well.
Well, this gentleman, it's not his real name, but you've called him Gul Mohammed. He talked about some of the things going on in his village that had drive people to join the Taliban. And here's some sound from his village.
Gul Mohammed plays a video of the funeral of a villager killed by American fire. Grieving relatives curse the invaders and call on God for help.
So is this the general motivation? Are these people who are angry over casualties and other effects inside Afghanistan that are being driven into the Taliban ranks?
It's certainly one issue. But what became clear talking to this young man and others is that early on after 2001, 2002, 2003, old Taliban commanders were trying to organize amongst the people there, and people didn't want to join up. They had some hope that the new Afghan government was going to really go places and they were going to see peace and security. And even, people said that they had hope in the foreign forces as well. And what's really caused what seems to be genuine local support for the Taliban is disenchantment with the Kabul government, with the government of Hamid Karzai. And in particular, people spoke about a police chief who was posted to their district, who was basically a robber. And they said that actually really made people want to join the Taliban again. So government corruption, I think, is the main thing.
Okay, Kate Clark, former BBC Kabul correspondent, thanks so much for joining us. Coming up, we're going to hear about some protests with a sense of humor. Stay with us.
John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. So in the 21st century, do protests have to be theatrical pranks to be effective? We'll talk about that in just a moment. First, here are some of the news stories we're following at 47 minutes past the hour. Don't wait for America. That's part of the message President Obama is delivering to the full UN General Assembly in just a few minutes. It's a full day of diplomacy for the president, and this afternoon he's meeting with Russia's President Medvedev. The massive flooding in the southeast has caused hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. At least 10 have died in the floods, mostly in Georgia. Rains are due to slow today.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports President Obama is considering alternatives to sending more troops to Afghanistan. One of the plans would reduce the number of U.S. forces there. It would focus more on rooting al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Sarah Palin is abroad today. She's on her first trip to Asia, where she had a paid speaking gig in Hong Kong. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning, John.
Those were all real stories. Thanks for those, Celeste. But you might say back in 2004, here was an example of where the news went terribly, terribly wrong.
He's a spokesman for Dow Chemicals. Good morning to you.
I'm very, very happy to announce that for the first time, Dow is accepting full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe. We have a $12 billion plan to finally, at long last, fully compensate the victims, including the 120,000 who may need medical care for their entire lives.
Oops, that was not a real Dow Chemical spokesman, and not a real apology by the not real spokesman for Dow Chemical's complicity in the Bhopal disaster more than 20 years ago. It was a prank, and it did make real news.
The BBC was forced to apologize to Dow Chemical today for broadcasting a hoax interview by an anti-corporate protester. The man appeared on BBC World claiming to be a representative of the Dow Chemical Group.
Well, the BBC had to apologize, and that man, Andy Bickelbaum, is one of the Yes Men, a group which specializes in protests that are more like theatrical pranks. Andy is actually in jail this morning, so he can't be here on the program, but his colleague Mike Bonanno is in the studio. He's also one of the Yes Men. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
And Steve Heller joins us. He's co-chair of the MFA design program at the School of Visual Arts and writes the visuals column for the New York Times Book Review. Stephen, good morning to you.
Hi, John.
So let's talk a little bit about what the Yes Men's mission is in an age where protest seems like it's very challenging for traditional protesters to get their message into the news cycle in the way that maybe was easier to do back in the 60s and 70s. Describe the motivation for the Bhopal protest, and where have you taken it from there?
Well, in the case of the Bhopal protest, we knew that we had the opportunity to speak live to potentially 350 million people. And Dow
by getting on the BBC.
By getting on the BBC, right. Precisely. And Dow had refused to take responsibility for the mess that Union Carbide created, even though they bought Union Carbide. They said when they bought it in 2001 that they had bought the all of the good parts without the bad parts, none of the liabilities, just the assets. And so we wanted to highlight that. And the only way that we knew that Dow would have to respond to us making an announcement was if we said that they were going to do the right thing. Because if we
in
said,
your view, the right thing.
Yeah, well,
right.
You know what? Not just in my view, but in anybody who's not a psychopath. Because everybody...
That is totally fair. But let me just say that by doing it as a prank, by structuring it as a prank, don't you signal to BBC listeners that, oh, that's not serious. So they were just fooling. So the apology is actually not something that actually happened, that it basically takes the focus off what you believe is the right thing to do.
Not at all, because, in fact, the apology is the only thing that forces Dow to stand up and say, we are not going to take responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe.
But, you know, following in that, we had reports of people in the area of Bhopal weeping when they discovered that it was actually a prank and Dow was not taking responsibility.
Aha, you have reports of that, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was true. If you go watch our movie, The Yes Men Fix the World, which is opening October 7th at Film Forum in New York, you will actually see that the people of Bhopal were overjoyed that the prank had happened because it actually got attention for their issue in the United States, where people have largely forgotten about the largest industrial accident in history.
Let's fast forward, because you're doing a lot of protests that are coinciding with the G20 and the UN meeting here in the United States and here in New York. Steve Heller, first of all, the future of protests, stunts and spectacles like this, and is that a good thing?
Stunts and spectacles are a double-edged sword. We've been doing them for years and years and years, and now we have more media to do them before. But I think that, you know, when the right people do it, it's called a stunt and a spectacle. When the wrong people do it, it's called dirty tricks. And I think I'm not sure how many people it sways. It brings public attention to a particular issue, perhaps, but often it backfires.
Well, Mike Bonanno, who is one of the Yes Men, how important is it for you to know tangibly that you're getting beyond simply selling videos of your very entertaining documentaries? And the piece we played of the Bhopal fake apology was from one of your documentaries.
Well, it's critically important that we're making a difference, because we're primarily activists. And the reason we do these very funny movies is because we want more people to get engaged with the ideas that we're discussing. And I think it's proven that these things do make a difference. I mean, one of the reasons why Michael Moore's documentaries are quite funny and not just all serious is because they reach more people. More people watch them. And I think that, you know, the evidence that we have of this is the same that the PR industry uses to charge more money. Basically, they have all these metrics like mind share. They've given it these sort of corporate terms, how many people see it, how many people are influenced. And if advertising didn't work, then people wouldn't be paying all that money for it.
Tell me about the survivaball. That's a tactic that you're starting to use, and I presume it's why Andy, your colleague, is arrested today, right?
That's precisely right. Yeah, a few years ago, we attended a conference as Halliburton.
Halliburton.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, we were impersonating Halliburton.
The defense contractor.
That's exactly right. And we went to a catastrophic loss conference, an insurance industry conference, and we presented their solution to climate change, which was a survival suit designed to save the CEOs, even if everybody else dies as a result of climate change.
Steve Heller is laughing. You like it. You like it.
I like it. I love the idea of it. And when I saw it in the film, I shuddered when they entered the convention hall with it and people started taking it seriously. To me, it was very similar to what Jon Stewart does with those fake interviews, which draws people out and exposes their foibles and follies.
But does it change minds? I mean, the Dow prank actually caused a reduction in Dow stock price, which actually had tangible, you know, billion dollar results. Does it change minds? Do you really do anything other than cause a retrenchment on the part of Halliburton and other defense contractors to watch out for loonies like you?
A lot of what we do, of course, has intangible results, but people are very entertained by it. A lot of people that we've been showing the movie to, especially high school kids who love the movie, haven't really thought about Halliburton before. And this gives them just a way to enter into it and begin to research it.
Well, let's say here a commercial for the Yes Men's Survivaball. At least you can't see it, but you'll get an idea of what we're talking about here.
Feeling like the world might be headed for disaster? Has the changing climate got you feeling down in the dumps? Well, worry no more. From the companies that Americans trust the most comes an amazing new product that just might save your life. The Survivaball, keeping you comfortable and cozy when Mother Nature lets you down.
Steve Heller, it seems, and we got to go pretty quickly, but the limitation of this whole genre of humor, prank, spectacle, clever theatrical protests is that how much convincing do you do? The people who already believe that way are going to be entertained. The people who don't will go, nye-nye-nye.
Well, it's the same with any kind of satire. Usually it does not convert. It just supports. And the more support you get, the better.
How do you convert rather than simply support the already convinced?
Well, our most recent event here where we published a fake New York Post, I think, takes a stab at that, because a lot of the articles in here are basically meant to appeal to the usual Post reader. So, for example, it talks about how the Pentagon is worried about climate change.
And so I guess if you get people on the subway to look at the fake Post and go, hey, is this real? Could this happen? Those conversations are tangible additions to the dialogue. Well, it's a yearning. We'll see how tangible it is. Mike Bonanno, one of the Yes Men. Also, Steve Heller was with us, joined co-chair of the MFA design program at the School of Visual Arts here in New York. He also writes the visuals column for the New York Times Book Review.
So head on over to our website. We have some videos of the Yes Men so you can see their pranks and of the interview with them in the studio as well. That's at thetakeaway.org. And as world leaders gather in Pittsburgh for the G20 summit, Matt emailed us some great photos from his mom of the city prepping and boarding up. Check those out also at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, we're getting ideas for your ideal grilled cheese sandwich. We're talking about websites where you can create and edit people's recipes. What's yours?
Here, Detroit, Michigan, just leave the grilled cheese as plain as it should be. Plain old cheese, just some nice white bread, toast it up, put it together, grill it up. Tasty.
George in Conway, South Carolina emails, the definitive Greek grilled cheese sandwich is defined not by the ingredients, but by where it's made. The perfect grilled cheese is prepared in a dusty parking lot at a Grateful Dead concert. Some great recipes and responses from you at thetakeaway.org.
We've also been talking about what makes an ugly American. You can weigh in on that at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway